Ladies and gentlemen, it's my pleasure to welcome to the Soleri Report Stephen Roche, who is a senior fellow at Yale University's Jackson Institute of Global Affairs and a senior lecturer at Yale School of Management. He is a former chairman of Morgan Stanley Asia and was the firm's chief economist for the majority of his 30-year career at Morgan Stanley. His most recent book, Unbalanced: The Codependency of America and China, published this year by Yale University Press, describes the risks and opportunities in the current China-U.S. economic relationship, and it's an excellent overview of what is China's current economy and some of the critical risks in the global economy. It's also described in his latest editorial in the Wall Street Journal, encouraging U.S. to seize the opportunity to rebalance ourselves and our relationship with China in a positive manner. And I recommend both the book and the editorial to you highly. They'll both be posted at the blog. So, Stephen, welcome to the Soleri Report.
Pleasure to be with you.
Well, before we start, I have to take the opportunity to thank you because during the financial crisis between 2006 and 2009, I kept hearing various pundits say, "Why did nobody warn us?" And I feel that you, at least in my experience, were unique in the top economists in the country to be warning us constantly about the problems in our financial system. And it's one of the reasons when you say something or you sound the alarm, I sit up and I take big notice, because I think you've had a very extraordinary and, I would say, fearless record of doing so. So on behalf of the investors of the world, thank you very much for everything you've done, including...
Well, I wish more had been skeptical leading up to that near-fatal experience. But, you know, everybody wants to believe until the end, in this case, the bitter end, and that was a tragedy that did not have to happen.
Well, exactly. And so hopefully this time around we're all going to take a notice, because I think the... Both in imbalanced and in unbalanced, and in the editorial, you make some strong and clear suggestions, and I think they're very much worth taking to heart. So let's start with what you describe in your first chapter of Unbalanced, the political economy of false prosperity, and sort of the economy that led us up to where we are. If you could describe that.
Well, it's pretty simple, actually. Everybody wants growth. Politicians wanted to get reelected. Individuals wanted to maintain or improve living standards. And regulators are often brought on for the ride by the same political consensus. And unfortunately, the quest for growth is so strong that it encourages those who manage economies to cut corners, and sometimes dangerous corners, to get us into trouble. And the story for the U.S. and China really began in the late 70s when both nations, both economies were in trouble. China was in the aftermath of this wrenching cultural revolution, and the U.S. was in the depths of a wrenching stagflation, low growth and high and rising inflation. And so we both concluded that growth was the answer, and we both offered something to the other in terms of enabling that growth. The U.S. consumers had huge demand for Chinese goods, and China could offer income-constrained Americans, you know, cheap goods, increasingly of a higher quality, to make ends meet. And so, you know, it was a marriage of convenience in the beginning, and but it led both economies down, I think, a road of excess that ultimately is now being addressed, either in the markets or in the strategic realignment of the respective economies.
And one of the things you point out is the extent to which Chinese savings helped finance this false prosperity. In other words, we borrowed money from China and used it to buy goods from them, and that created employment for them, and around we go.
Yeah, it's what I call the book. It's sort of a classic codependent relationship, which is actually, in the end, a psychologist who studies codependency in the context of human relationships will tell you is unhealthy and unsustainable. And I'm afraid the economist will end up giving the same prognosis. China saves more than any country has ever saved, and we save less than any country has ever saved. So we borrowed freely from China, the surplus saving it didn't need because it was more of a producer than a consumer. And we use that saving to fund or to compensate for our lack of saving and to fund our budget deficits and kept growing. But that's the big issue that now needs to be addressed, because China's recognized that this is not a sustainable path for itself and wants to use its surplus saving to help support the safety net of its own people. And the U.S. really doesn't get that. You know, we still think that we can draw on China's saving to help our people. And you know, something tells me that's not going to add up over the next several years.
One of the reasons I really enjoyed reading the book was I got a much better sense for the reforms underway and what you describe as the rebalancing of the economy in China and sort of where things are. Maybe if you could describe what's underway and the changes that are happening in the Chinese economy.
Sure. Well, the debate began in earnest about a little over 7 years ago when the former premier of China, Premier Wen Jiabao, said at a time of what seemed to be great strength and optimism in the Chinese economy that while the economy is strong on the surface, beneath the surface, it is unstable, unbalanced, uncoordinated, and ultimately unsustainable. And that triggered a huge and intense internal debate about the sustainability of China. And the decision was made a little over 3 years ago, after 4 years of internal debate, to shift the model away from being a producer that drove the economy through exports and investment into more of a consumer. And China passed one of its 5 year plans, in this case the so-called 12th 5 year plan, in March of 2011, that was aimed at a rebalancing of the Chinese economy, moving away from exports and investment as the drivers of growth to something that relies more on internal private consumption by fostering new sources of job growth in the services sector, which is too small in China, higher real wages through urbanization, and an improved safety net to make sure that that families spend the newfound labor income rather than save it out of fear. And, you know, the plan was helpful, provided broad guidelines. A couple of the legs were put in place, especially the jobs and the real wages through services and urbanization. But the safety net really remained porous and inadequate. And what the government has subsequently done to the 12th five-year plan is that they really fleshed out through a series of comprehensive and really unprecedented reforms enacted or ratified, I should say, last November at what is now known as the third plenum meeting of the Central Committee of the Chinese Communist Party. Lots of reforms that will be helpful to deal with the insecurities of the safety net. So the bottom line is that China is now on the road to rebalancing. It's going to be a long and arduous road, but they're doing it. And for a nation like the United States, codependency with China simply means that we've got to stand up and take notice of the fact that our partner, who had long been providing us with the saving we needed to grow, is going to do something else, and we need to respond strategically in the way that enables us to stay our course.
So China's rebalancing, but we're not. One of the things I thought you did an excellent job in the book is talking about the policy mechanisms for long-term strategic planning in China, which are really absent in the United States.
Yeah, no, we don't do strategy. You know, we make fun of it. You know, we had one of, I guess, Bush, the first sort of made some derogatory comments to the so-called vision thing. We rely on the invisible hand of Adam Smith to set strategy and to guide us through market-based resource allocation. A lot of this is, you know, sort of, you know, it's helpful in rationalizing the growth of our economy after the fact. But in a competitive world where we're all interlinked and countries that had been on the outside looking in for years are now in the thick of things, I think we need more than the invisible hand to help us meet these tough competitive challenges head on. We need strategy, and yet we don't do strategy, and we make fun of those who do, saying, oh, it smacks of the old Soviet-style central planning, and look what happened to the former Soviet Union. It's not about ideology. It's about being practical and having the wherewithal as a nation to face up to issues that we need to grapple with to sustain the vigor longstanding of the American economy. And if we don't think strategically, we risk squandering that.
One of the big questions in the rebalancing of both countries is, we know we're experiencing an enormous wave of automation and potential automation. And it's coming to the, you know, or it's moving through the United States economy, and I'm sure it is moving through the Chinese economy. And of course, the big issue in both countries is how do you create employment? How do you maintain employment? What happens to incomes when automation rises? Maybe if you could speak to that.
Well, I think that you know, we're in an era of intense technological change. There's a lot of debate on how unique this is relative to earlier periods. But notwithstanding that, you know, debate, certainly in manufacturing businesses, the substitution of machines for people, capital for labor, is pretty much across the board. It's just hard to drive employment and labor income through manufacturing-led development. And so China's got a huge advantage in this regard, because they don't really have a services sector that is even close to being on the scale that they need to establish a more modern economy. Their services sector is today about 46% of the GDP, which is up a little bit over the last few years, but you know, it should be 55, 60, 65%, and probably will be between now and 2025. Services are labor intensive. They do generate jobs. In the case of China, an average unit of services GDP generates 30% more jobs per unit of output than does manufacturing and construction combined. So China's now growing out its services economy, from wholesale and retail trade to domestic transportation, supply chain logistics, hospitality and leisure, finance, and the big one, healthcare. And as they do that, I think you know, they'll continue to experience more rapid growth in job creation than others, largely because of the unmet needs they have in developing this labor-intensive services economy. And they can, you know, they're not immune to the technologies to replace workers with machines, but in services, you need a lot more workers than you do elsewhere. And so you have some cushion from that blow.
And you think that this is an area where the United States is a potential area of opportunity for U.S. businesses?
I think there's huge opportunity there. We tend in this country, the debate right now is to view China as nothing but risk and danger. We focus on issues, you know, like a currency policy, the tensions in the East China Sea, the South China Sea, the great cyber hacking controversy. We really paint China with a very dark brush. I'm not minimizing any of these issues. These are all issues that need to be addressed, I would add, in an even-handed way, which we don't seem to be capable of. But nevertheless, I can see that they should be addressed. But I don't think we should lose sight of the opportunities that this consumer-led, services-led development will provide for the United States. I have estimates in my book that the services economy in China alone will expand by roughly $12 trillion U.S. dollars between now and 2025. And I also have estimates that I would argue that between 35 to 50% of that is tradable. In other words, we can, and other service providers can satisfy the demand for Chinese services through our companies rather than have them do that just through their own indigenous companies. And for the final piece is the U.S. is the largest and most competitive services economy in the world. We account for a total of 14% of all services exports today, which is 50% larger than number two. And shame on us if we can't seize the opportunity that's about to be created by this services-led growth bonanza in China. And this is what I wrote about in the Wall Street Journal op-ed piece that you cited in the intro.
Right. I think, you know, one of the reasons I was so impressed by the editorial is it's really focusing on, you know, it's through those kind of opportunities that we can rebalance into a more positive relationship, but we can also, you know, the way to settle your differences is to get busy building the opportunities and to diminish the reasons for squabbling. I was very glad to see you had that chapter on the cyber hacking, because that's one of the areas that concerns me the most. You know, I was a great fan of Alexander Hamilton, and one of the first things he did when he set up the Treasury Department was create a Department of Standards and Codes. And what you see happening between China and the United States is a real deterioration of trust in the basic standard and codes of various products and relationships. And that is a concern, because if you're going to use a system to fight, you can't use it to build. And I'm not, you know, that to me is one of the questions. How do we get out of this increasing distrust of each other's quality of product?
Look, I think those are perfectly legitimate concerns. Just maybe 11 months ago at the annual strategic and economic dialogue between the United States and China, and another one is coming up in just a few weeks, this issue first came to a head. Both governments agreed after, you know, charges and countercharges to set up a working group that would at least allow a sharing of information on cyber threats and hopefully develop some mutually acceptable codes of conduct in the area of cyber commerce and cyber data gathering. And some progress is being made, but at least there was a working group that was focused on the issue. And then, you know, the Department of U.S. Department of Justice took matters in its own hands recently, and it took what is by now a pretty dated report put out by a private cybersecurity firm in the United States and turned that into an indictment in a very widely publicized case, indicting five officers of the Chinese Army for cyber crimes. And you know, the unfortunate repercussion of that is that all efforts at mutual cooperation through this working group on cyber issues between the U.S. and China has now been suspended, and it's hard to know when and if it will be restarted. And, you know, the U.S. has every right to protect its companies and its workers, but on the other hand, you know, there's a certain amount of hypocrisy involved here. In the aftermath of the revelations of, you know, our own cyber hacker, Edward Snowden, who pointed out that, you know, America is guilty of, or allegedly guilty, I should say, of equally egregious but different crimes of hacking into the lives of its own citizens, foreign leaders, trade negotiators, And in, you know, some cases, the private companies like Petrobras and Huawei in China. So, you know, it's a little ironic. I mean, who are we to be, you know, calling the, you know, the kettle black here? And so,
well, it was really funny. I theme on the Solaire report following that in, and inspired by that was the pot calls the kettle black. Yeah. One of the points you made.
As an example of, again, go back to my my amateurish diagnosis as as an economist masquerading as a psychologist. This is sort of a manifestation of the classic blame game of codependency. You know,
right.
One needy partner blames the other, and the other one turns around and blames the other one.
Right. One of the things I thought was great in Unbalanced is you make the point again and again, and it's very. It's something that is very coherent for a non-economist is that you can't solve a multilateral problem with a bilateral solution, and that, you know, many of the squabbles we hear coming out of Congress between the U.S. and China are really, you know, reflect problems that the U.S. has on a multilateral basis, and it just can't be solved with their just attending to the relationship with China. And I think, you know, that's one of the reasons I'm really going to encourage our subscribers to read the book, because it's a very important thing, and it would be terrible if Congress fell into that trap.
Well, I'm glad you picked up on that, because that's something I've just felt very strongly about, and I've personally testified in front of the Congress on this for years, and, you know, it's just, you know, it rings on deaf ears. And, you know, the simple point is that, you know, America doesn't save, and when we don't save, we want to grow, we import surplus savings from abroad, from countries like China. But to import that surplus savings, we have to run these big imbalances on our international balance of payments, and behind every balance of payments deficit are multilateral trade deficits. In the case of the U.S., over 100, we have deficits with over 100 countries. And so, you know, if we try to address our trade problem, which we judge to be so damaging to American workers, on a bilateral basis, and say shut down trade with China, the Chinese beast just goes somewhere else. And who are we kidding? You know, that somewhere else will be a higher cost producer, and that'll tax American consumers. So the idea that we can solve this inherently domestic imbalance that we created ourselves by not saving, which has all these very visible multilateral manifestations, by bashing China is really unfortunate and risks being a policy blunder of epic proportions.
Do you see any of the effort to build more energy sufficiency in the U.S. or to rebuild manufacturing as signs that we are trying to rebalance?
Well, I think the energy breakthroughs recently are potentially of enormous importance to the United States. I don't think they arose out of a conscious strategic effort to find a new recipe for rebalancing. I think they came out of the ingenuity and entrepreneurial and innovative spirit of American businessmen responding to market forces of higher oil and developing new technologies to exploit an enormous reservoir of natural gas and oil that could not be obtained by traditional technologies. Will that be sufficient to enable the U.S. to rebalance? Is maybe a better way to put it. And I don't think that's enough, Catherine. I think we got to do more than just focus on fracking as the answer to what ails us competitively. And I continue to believe that until or unless we really have a much broader debate on the need to boost national saving, and by that I mean not just government budget deficits, but the savings of individuals and businesses as well, that we're not going to have the wherewithal to fund future technology and developments or rebuilding of manufacturing that is so widely being talked about in this era of presumed energy independence is looming on the not-so-distant horizon.
A lot of my work in the 90s was focused on how do you re-engineer government investment by place, essentially county by county, you know, sort of the bottom-up re-engineering. And I've always believed there was an extraordinary opportunity to do so. But if you look at the economy at a county level now in the United States, the number of people who are directly, indirectly dependent on federal subsidies is so extraordinary. There's no way you can increase the savings rate without dramatically also re-engineering government investment, which is there to be done. But it's, you know, it requires, before you can even contemplate doing it, you require sort of the, you know, the vision thing. You need a strategic conversation at a very high level to say, okay, you know, we have to do this. It's going to impact everybody. Let's talk about it.
I agree with you, but you know, it's just become all too easy for our elected leaders to, you know, continue to kick this can or that can down the road and try to rekindle the animal spirits that have long supported the consumption binge that we as a nation have been on now for 15 years. And consumption is fine if you've got the income and the wherewithal to support it, but we don't. And, you know, our national savings rate is as low as any leading nation has ever had it. Our personal savings rate is less than half its historic average. We still have exceptionally high debt loads and of American families, and we yet continue to harbor the belief that, well, you know, all we need to do is get consumer spending again and things will be fine. And I worry that that is the antithesis of the rebalancing and shift to saving that I think we actually need for longer term economic growth.
One last question I had for you is, you know, traditionally the U.S. has been an equity oriented or a more equity oriented society than foreign investors. And I'm wondering if the development of the emerging markets, if the growth of China is, we're going to start to see Asian consumers, Asian investors start to be equity oriented, whether directly or through, as you said, more social safety nets. If you think there's a shift coming in, you know, towards equity investment as a result of the development.
Well, I mean, I think that the emergence of the Chinese middle class will possibly be one of the great growth opportunities of the world will see in this century. And whether or not that has positive consequences for equity markets, either in China or around the world, remains to be seen. A lot of that depends on the way in which the government reforms its own practices of transparency and both public and private sector governance itself. As I look out over the next, you know, 5 to 10 years, I think that China gets it, and the equity market, which has been a major underperformer for the last 7 years, will significantly outperform most of the averages in the developing world, and will give the developed markets a run for their money. So we'll have to wait and see if China can deliver on its own governance reforms to justify that admittedly optimistic prognosis.
Right. Oh, I think they can, but it's interesting. That's one of the areas where a real investment in services could make a big improvement. As you said, the China Strategic and Economic Dialogue is coming up in July. It's going to be in Beijing. What do you think is going to happen? What should we look to as we watch the U.S. and China try and talk about these things?
Well, I think these are, you know, potentially important developments, but the posturing ahead of this particular strategic and economic dialogue has been very negative, with the outbreak of tensions in the East China Sea, the South China Sea, the cyber hacking issues, the Congress once again raising concerns, and the Treasury as well, about currency manipulation, and you know, China's got its own internal issues that it's dealing with. So I worry about this particular dialogue as really not moving the ball ahead much, and I hopefully there's no sidetracking or I should say backtracking on this relationship. A year ago, there was some progress made in setting up negotiations for what we call a bilateral investment treaty, and there are a number of them. I wrote about this in the Wall Street Journal as well, in that op-ed piece you cited. There are over 3,000 of them around the world, and you know, we would benefit enormously from having one with China. I think the Chinese have reluctantly come to that agreement as well, and so we were making progress, and I'd love to see more progress on that front come out of this next strategic and economic dialogue in a few weeks. But the way things stand right now, I think the odds of that are not as high as I'd like them to be, and that's too bad.
The you know, one of my favorite lines for music is Tina Turner singing, "We can do this nice or rough." And, you know, the rebalancing between the United States and China is going to happen. And as you rightly point out in your book, this is not a concern of the two countries. It's a concern of the whole world. Because if it gets rough, it could have dramatic implications, not just for our two economies, but the entire global economy. So I think one of the things I'd like to do is put this interview up on the blog and do everything I can to pressure everyone to remember investors and citizens are going to be much better off if we figure out how to do it nice. Is that fair to say?
Well, look, you're preaching to singing to the choir on this one. I mean, I think there are always issues that need to be ironed out. There are differences that need to be ironed out between any two nations, and that's certainly true of the U.S. and China. But if all we can do is focus on the risks of the relationship, we risk squandering the opportunities. China is changing its economy. It's a huge opportunity for us if we really align our economic strengths with the shifts that are going on in China. We need a new source of growth after this financial crisis, and China will
here it is
provide a very important opportunity for us, but you know, shame on us if we squander it.
I just have to tell you one story. In 1997, I was in Beijing, and I had a wonderful guy working for me who was a PRC citizen, and we were sitting reading the paper in the morning, and there was a big squabble going on between the U.S. administration and China, and the Henry said to me, do you know what's going on? And I said, no, I really don't understand. And he said, the majority of your legislators are lawyers, and the majority of our legislators are engineers and economists. And the lawyers are saying, you will do this. And the economists and engineers are saying, how?
Well, those are, sometimes things don't change much. Maybe we don't.
Well, tell us, how can we stay current on your work?
Well, I write about it on a regular basis. I publish articles in newspapers. You can enroll. You can come back to college and go to Yale and take my courses. I'm no longer at Morgan Stanley, but I still try to stay very active in the public debate. So there's in all of my stuff is free and out there for easy consumption.
Okay, well, you've made an enormous contribution. If we had done it, what you said before, we would never have had the financial crisis. So I can't tell you how much I appreciate everything, and we will get this up on the blog and encourage everybody to read the book and the editorial, and hopefully if it...
Send me a link when it's up there.
Okay, will do. Steve, you have a great day.
You too, Catherine. Thanks. Bye.